it is really important to understand every management, every CEO at every company of any size considers him or herself very important. But it's critical in small companies.
Die Geldmeisterin. Der Finanzpodcast mit Julia Kistner. Und mit diesen Top-Themen der Woche. Megaprozess um Aktienabstürze. Halb so viel Wirbel um das Woodstock der Kapitalisten in Omaha ohne Charlie Munger. Heiße US-Unternehmensbilanzen am Super Tuesday, unter anderem von Flaggschiff Walt Disney. Die Zahlen sind auf Kurs, doch der Börsenkurs knickt. Vergesst also die großkapitalisierten Aktien und Small ist wieder beautiful? Das meint zumindest Michelle Ward, Aktienportfoliospezialistin von T. Rowe Price, zu Gast bei der Geldmeisterin in dieser Folge. Doch zuvor noch der Finanzprozess der Woche über einen der spektakulärsten US-Aktienkollapse, der vor rund 3 Jahren seinen Ausgang nahm. Sagt euch Bill Huang vielleicht noch etwas? Nein? Oder sein Family Office Archegos Capital? Nein? Falls ihr schon zumindest 3 Jahre in Aktien investiert seid, dann garantiere ich euch, dass dieser Mann, Bill Huang, Ende März 2021 auch euch verärgert hat. Damals fielen aus heiterem Himmel plötzlich Aktien ins Bodenlose, die im ersten Moment gar nichts miteinander zu tun hatten. Es begann mit dem Medienkonzern Viacom CBS, dann stürzten wie Dominosteine weitere Titel, darunter Discovery und chinesische Blue Chips wie Tencent und Baidu. Auch alternative Investments stürzten ab. Mehrere 10 Milliarden an Börsenwert wurden in kürzester Zeit vernichtet und man rätselte, ob sich das Ganze zu einem globalen Aktiencrash ausbreitet und vor allem wer oder was dahinter steckt. Tatsächlich war es ein einziger Mann, Bill Huang. Er hatte mit seinem Family Office um ein Vielfaches von dem, was er sich wirklich leisten konnte, Aktien gekauft. Das Geld lieh er sich, geschickt und unbemerkt, bei vielen verschiedenen Investmentbanken aus. Das Ganze funktionierte über Aktienswaps. Das sind Wetten mit einer Bank, bei der die Bank für dich gegen eine Gebühr Aktien kauft. Steigen die Aktien, ist alles gut, weil dann erhältst du die Zuwächse und Dividenden und kannst damit die Leihgebühr bezahlen und machst damit auch noch fette Gewinne. So wuchs zwischen 2020 und 2021 das von Archegos Capital veranlagte Investmentvolumen laut Financial Times von rund 1,5 auf rund 35 Milliarden US-Dollar. Doch wehe, wenn die Kurse unerwartet fallen. Dann kommt es zur sogenannten Margin Call und man muss der Bank Geld nachschießen. Fehlt dann das Geld dafür, musst du Aktien verkaufen. Nicht nur du, sondern auch, wie im Fall Bill Huang, die Investmentbanken, weil sie ihm viel zu viel Geld geliehen hatten. So eine Aktion bringt dann auch Aktien gesunder Unternehmen zum Absturz. Alleine die Credit Suisse schädigte Bill Huang damals mit 4 Milliarden US-Dollar. 3 Jahre später geht es jetzt im Prozess darum, ob Bill Huang kriminell gehandelt hat oder nicht. Vom Investmentvehikel Family Office wird eben immer noch nicht die gleiche Transparenz wie etwa von Fonds verlangt, weil man ja vermeintlich nur sein eigenes, wenn auch geliehenes Geld veranlagt und nicht das anderer Leute. Huangs Anwälte argumentieren auch, die Banken, die ihm so viel Geld geborgt haben, hätten ihre Sorgfaltspflicht verletzt. Das Verfahren in Manhattan dauert voraussichtlich 8 Wochen. Was ich jetzt schon sagen kann, an den großen gesetzlichen Schrauben, mehr Transparenz bei den großen Wahlen der Wall Street, wird deshalb auch nicht gedreht. Die Moral von der Geschichte? Besser nicht zu viel hebeln. Zu viel Cash. Das umgekehrte Problem hat derzeit Warren Buffett und seine Beteiligungsholding Berkshire Hathaway. Ihnen wurde bei der jüngsten Hauptversammlung vorgeworfen, sie verfügten über zu viel Cash, was auch nicht ganz falsch ist. Denn Ende des ersten Quartals erreichte ihr Bargeldbestand tatsächlich eine Rekordhöhe von 189 Milliarden US-Dollar. Und Warren gibt offen zu, er wisse nicht, wohin mit dem Geld. Und der Cashberg wird noch in diesem Quartal auf 200 Milliarden US-Dollar ansteigen. Es gäbe derzeit einfach keine Milliardendeals mehr, die hohe Gewinne versprechen. So wie zuletzt der Kauf der Beteiligungsfirma Allegheny Corporation und weitere Beteiligungen am Ölmulti Occidental Petroleum. Ganz kann ich seiner Argumentation allerdings nicht folgen. Denn warum verkauft er dann im ersten Quartal auch noch 13% seiner Apple-Aktien um 38,9 Milliarden US-Dollar, wenn er ohnehin beklagt, dass er um sein Cash nichts kaufen kann? Da werde ich schon eher bei seiner zweiten Bemerkung schlau, dass er in einer zunehmenden, komplizierten und verflochtenen Welt bereit sein möchte, Gelegenheiten zu nutzen, wenn sie sich bieten. Denn man muss wissen, auch in die Finanzkrise starteten Warren Buffett und sein Kompagnon Charlie Munger mit hohen Cash-Reserven und profitierten dann von einer kapitalen Schnäppchenjagd. Hoffen wir doch, dass Warren sein goldenes Näschen diesmal täuscht und die aktuellen Krisenherde sich in Wohlgefallen auflösen. Wie Warren Buffett die Weltmarkt- und Börsenlage insgesamt einschätzt und mehr zu seinen einzelnen Beteiligungen und Investmentideen, hört ihr in der nächsten Podcast-Folge der Geldmeisterin mit dem prominenten deutschen Value-Investor Hendrik Leber. Was Apple noch bieten kann. Eines habe ich Warren Buffett bereits vor dem Annual Meeting von Berkshire Hathaway gleich gemacht. Ich habe Apple-Aktien zu einem für mich guten Preis von 186,5 US-Dollar in der Vorwoche verkauft. Es ist ja immer eine Frage des Einstiegspreises. Ich hatte Apple doch einige Jahre und wollte sie eigentlich im Langfristportfolio belassen. Aber irgendwie beginne ich langsam zu zweifeln, dass das Apple-Geschäftsmodell nachhaltig ertragreich bleibt. Mir fehlen momentan die Innovationen, auch beim Bestseller iPhone. Das ist natürlich meine ganz persönliche Meinung. Eure Meinung zu Apple würde mich natürlich auch interessieren. Hinterlasst mir doch bitte einen Kommentar oder schreibt mir an julia@geldmeisterin.com. Warren Buffett betonte letzte Woche hingegen, dass er mit einem Anteil von rund 135,4 Milliarden US-Dollar an Apple als seine größte Beteiligung festhält. Mich hat jedenfalls auch der dieswöchige große Apple-Event Let Loose enttäuscht. Einzig Hoffnung macht mir der im neuen, sündteuren OLED iPad Pro verbaute M4-Chip, der die neue Generation der Apple-Geräte antreiben soll, dabei aber bei gleicher Leistung nur ein Viertel des Stroms verbraucht und mit KI-Fähigkeiten punkten soll. Super Tuesday, Walt Disneys Zahlen überraschen positiv, doch der Kurs enttäuscht. Eine Enttäuschung war der Superdienstag der Bilanzsaison, an dem etwa auch BP und Ferrari seine Bücher öffnete. Wenn man mal von der bestens verdienenden Bank UBS absieht, die auch offenlegte. Trotz guter Quartalszahlen ging es bei den meisten Aktien nach der Veröffentlichung der Zahlen bergab, weil die Börse immer in die Zukunft schaut und die Gewinnerwartungen der Unternehmen dort etwas gedämpfter sind. So erging es auch Walt Disney, denn man weniger Potenzial zutraut, obwohl der Unterhaltungskonzern im Streaming-Bereich mit Disney Plus und Hulu erstmals im ersten Quartal 24 einen Gewinn von 47 Millionen US-Dollar machte, gegenüber noch Verlusten von 587 Millionen US-Dollar im Vergleichsquartal des Vorjahres. Die Aktionäre dankten dies Disney nicht. Die Aktie verlor sogar sofort 9%. Es waren nicht nur die Nutzerzahlen von Disney Plus, die enttäuschten. 2 Millionen weniger Abonnenten sind schon eine ganze Menge. Besorgniserregend für Disney ist vor allem, was man von Indien hört. Disney muss bei seiner indischen Beteiligung Star India und dem Kabelfernsehgeschäft hohe Abschreibungen und einen Verlust von 20 Millionen Dollar verbuchen, nachdem Disney im Vorjahr noch einen Gewinn von 1,3 Milliarden Dollar dort verbuchte. Aber nicht nur dem Fernsehen, auch den Lichtspielhäusern, die Disney fleißig in Indien bespielt, laufen die Besucher davon. Stattdessen sind Musikgroßveranstaltungen mehr angesagt. Mehr zu Indien und seinen neuen Potenzialen in der nächsten Podcast-Folge der Geldmeisterin. Ich habe mich jedenfalls von meinen Disney-Aktien im Nachhinein zum Glück kurz vor dem Super Tuesday getrennt. Und so habe ich mir auch den Kursrutsch erspart. Auch bei Disney fehlt mir die Vision für ein langfristig gut funktionierendes Geschäftsmodell. Momentan kann ich mir nicht vorstellen, dass Streaming mal ein wirklich gutes Geschäft wird. Small is beautiful. Haben die großen Werte also ihre besten Zeiten schon hinter sich? Mir fehlt noch trotz allem die Vorstellungsgabe, dass es jetzt eine gute Zeit sei, auf Small Caps umzuschwenken, nur weil alle Fondsmanager derzeit euphorisch für die kleinen Werte sind. Vielleicht überzeugt das Kurs-Gewinn-Verhältnis des Russell 2000, der kleine US-Aktien beinhaltet, im Vergleich zum S&P 500, der ja die 500 größten Börsenwerte in den USA abbildet. Das Kurs-Gewinn-Verhältnis des Russell 2000 Index liegt bei 15,7, des S&P 500 bei 26,7. Die großen Börsenflaggschiffe sind also deutlich höher bewertet. Das allein überzeugt noch nicht, dass Small Caps im Langfristportfolio unbedingt dabei sein müssen, aber vielleicht als gute Ergänzung zu den ETFs auf die großen Weltmarktindizes, die kleinkapitalisierte Werte nämlich nicht beinhalten. Doch Vorsicht, gerade bei Small Caps heißt es, auf die Qualität zu achten, was nicht ganz so einfach ist. Aber hören wir uns doch die Pros und Cons aus der Sicht von Michelle Ward, Aktienexpertin bei T. Rowe Price an.
Yeah, thank you for being guest on Geldmeisterin Mrs. Michelle Ward. Maybe you could briefly introduce yourself to the audience.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm Michelle Ward. I'm one of the portfolio specialists at T. Rowe Price, and I am responsible for talking about our strategies in the small and mid-cap part of the U.S. equity market.
And how would you define small, mid, and large cap?
So it's always a moving target. We use the Russell indices to create definitions. Mm-hmm. For the small cap market, we usually consider that the world of the Russell 2000. And so that typically is the smallest companies up to those about $6 billion in market mm-hmm. cap. Mid-cap starts there and then goes up to maybe 30, 35, 50 billion. The upper end there is a little bit, again, a moving target. Mm-hmm. And then large cap we define typically more by way of the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. And that migrates down to maybe that 30 billion category. So there's a bit of overlap on each of these definitions. Between what is small and mid, what is mid and large.
But I just want to hear, because it's small, it's quite huge for Austrian sizes, so you won't have an Austrian company in your small cap fund.
that is something we find very true. Yeah. The U.S. equity market is very different to those outside the United States.
Mm-hmm. And small caps could not outperform large caps now for decades. And why do you think this will be different this year?
Well, this has been true. There have been long periods of time in the past where large cap stocks have outperformed, just as they have for the last decade or so. But then other years and eras, literally up to a decade, where small cap stocks have been the leaders in the market. So it is a typically long cycle, but not unprecedented. Why now would small caps start to outperform? And that's, by as you might imagine, a question I get a lot.
Yeah.
The question, I think, comes down to when large caps start to lose the power that they have had in the market. And we've seen this experience in the past, early 70s and then the late 1990s, early 2000s. Periods of time where, just like today, the top end of the S&P 500 got very concentrated, have in the past exploded. Mm-hmm. The bubble has burst. And it's often the case that in the past, it's just a matter that expectations got so high and it's so extended that those great companies could no longer sustain the period of outperformance that drove them to the levels they are today. Mm-hmm. When that happens, the market starts to look around for what else they can invest in. And one of those areas in the past has been small cap stocks. Just like today, in the past, small cap stocks had been very undervalued, mostly because no one was paying attention. Mm-hmm. The companies themselves continued to deliver really strong returns, but the market was just so focused, so concentrated in its attention span, as well as the valuations. Now, you have to have a backdrop for that. And the backdrop really is a very positive tone for the U.S. economy. More positive than you typically see in the headlines of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. There's good things happening with the consumer, with the corporate environment that create a positive environment for these small companies that are more focused on the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm. But what does it help to have a good area now for the small caps, but nobody is paying attention? Like, some are not allowed to pay attention. If I think of the institutional investors, they often can't invest in small caps because of their size and liquidity. Isn't this a disadvantage for small caps?
Well, in the United States, every institutional investor, and frankly, every retail investor, has an allocation to small cap stocks.
Ah, okay.
It is a structurally important part of anyone's asset allocation profile. Because U.S. investors at least understand the long-term upside potential of small cap stocks. Now, that's not necessarily true when you go outside the United States. And indeed, that's why we created the strategy that I'm talking about at the Funds Congress today. This is an area that a lot of non-U.S. investors haven't invested in. It's not necessarily for liquidity reasons, perhaps, because in a liquid CCAV vehicle, OEIC vehicle, etc., you have ultimate same-day liquidity. So there's no issue there, and we're able to manage our liquidity within the fund pretty well. But the most typical non-U.S. investor just has an S&P 500 allocation, and they miss the roughly 20% of the U.S. equity market that lives below the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
And they're missing a lot of upside. That's what we have found by investing in this part of the market for decades.
Uh-huh. So there would be synergies to have also small caps because you don't have them in the S&P 500.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. In the world of the Russell 2500, which our U.S. smaller companies equity strategy uses as its benchmark, there's only about 2% overlap of the S&P 500. So that means that there's a lot of untapped potential in the world that lives below the S&P.
Mm-hmm. And how do you handle transparency? For example, that we have really nice companies in Vienna on the stock exchange, but we have no analysts which cover these companies, and small caps are also often hardly covered. How do you handle this?
Well, we think it's a real advantage for T. Rowe Price to have that lack of efficiency in the marketplace, because we have a team of almost 50 analysts who can look through the market. And the market opportunity is very large. There's about 3,000 companies we could invest in relative to the world of the Russell 2500. So to have 32 research analysts and another 17 associate analysts, so almost 50 people out there looking for companies day in and day out, it's a huge advantage that no one else is looking at these companies. Because when we find one and they ultimately prove their worth, we can reap the rewards in terms of the stock alpha that we get.
So there's much opportunity for fund managers to get alpha in the small caps area.
Exactly. And it's an area where the passive benchmark presents its own set of risks and challenges. The quality of the benchmark has eroded over time, simply because there are fewer and fewer public companies in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
25 years ago, there were over 7,000 public companies in the U.S. Today, there's less than 4,000. And there's still a lot of capital moving into the United States market. So the indices have had to scoop up a lot of companies at the bottom of the barrel, and they're not always the highest quality. So a passive vehicle, you own all of that. Whereas with an active manager, you have someone picking and choosing, identifying which companies really have the staying power and which ones do not.
You talked about quality. This is a really important thing in small caps. And what would you say, isn't it that the quality get worse in general of small caps because we have private equity, which gets the top of the cake?
It can be true. So it's important, though, not to generalize.
Yeah.
There are very high quality, very small companies, as well as very poor quality, larger companies. So it's not all things are always true for this part of the market. It is very
heterogeneous, a very different one company than the next, which again is why having the research team we do allows us to identify the real winners and losers in the marketplace. Generally speaking, though, these companies are smaller, they're less diversified, they may be one product companies or one market companies. So you really do need to think about what's not just their experience today, but what's their potential down the road.
Mm-hmm. And what are you doing if a small cap is rising and it's not anymore a small cap? Isn't this also a problem for a fund manager, also for a passive ETF?
So it is definitely a challenge for a portfolio manager. When do you choose to sell a winner?
Yeah.
Because that is the ultimate challenge.
Yeah.
Small cap stocks, the world of the Russell 2500, go up to about $18 billion on the most recent rebalancing anyway. And so we do let our winners run. So we'll continue to hold names as they pass that $18 billion threshold. But as they hit 25, 30 billion, we have to start taking money off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. And we try to do that, though, on a slow and deliberate fashion. Because we typically see there's often a large amount of growth still to come. And so we want to take our time walking to the exit door. But as we will all ultimately have to do, we will eventually have to exit positions. We don't set ourselves a hard and fast rule.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, look for new, smaller ideas within that individual sector or industry to redeploy the capital as we have a successful investment.
But it's for sure not a buy and hold strategy, I guess. How long do you keep small caps, more or less?
It is actually a little bit more buy and hold than you might think.
Yeah.
We'll trade around the position size. We make initial investments with a 3 to 5 year time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
That said, we have names in the portfolio that are over a decade mm-hmm. of holding, consistent holding. So if we can hold a name for longer, we love to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those companies still stay pretty small. Some are graduating as we speak and in becoming the large cap names of the future. But the longer you hold a company, the better you get to know them, the more contact you have with management teams. And so there is an inherent advantage to that long-term holding as well.
For dividend chasers, small caps is not the right sizer.
Typically, these companies do not pay dividends. There are certain companies that do, but many are using their capital instead to grow,
mm-hmm.
whether it's by making organic investments in their businesses or making acquisitions of other companies. And acquisitions in the small cap space can be truly transformative. You often see large cap companies that make an acquisition, and it's a small tuck-in acquisition. It doesn't really change the character of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But when a small cap company makes an acquisition, it really can transform a company both for the better or for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why we spend so much time getting to know management teams, the
mm-hmm.
people who are making these decisions.
Yeah.
What are their motivations and their incentive structure? How successful have they been at making acquisitions and integrating them in the past?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're essentially letting them do our work for us. Creating and transforming companies over time is part and parcel of their challenge. And if they're good at it, that's wonderful. And
mm-hmm.
if they're not so good, that can be an issue.
But this is also interesting. The quality of the management is more important than in the big companies, you think? And this, the open AI or the AI can't find out the quality of the management. Although you also have an alpha.
It is really important to understand the management teams at these smaller companies. I'm sure every management, every CEO at every company of any size considers him or herself very important. But it's critical in small companies. And not just the CEO and CFO, but we take our time to get to know the layers below that level. The chief scientific officer at a biotech company, the property managers at some of the REITs, the chief lending officer at a bank. They're the people that really make a strategy happen. And so getting to know them is important because it lets us know whether a strategy is attainable or not.
Mm-hmm.
We also try to get to know those management teams and the divisional leadership, because sometimes a divisional leadership at a large company will find themselves at the helm as the CEO and CFO of
a small company one day. That's how we found the management team at Molina Healthcare, which is one of our holdings. They came from a large cap insurer to a small cap insurance company and really transformed that company based on the experience and skills they had developed while at their larger cap counterpart.
Mm-hmm. And where do I find small quality?
Small quality actually can be found just about anywhere if you look hard enough. There are great companies in every sector, which is one of the reasons why we always invest in every sector and in most of the important industries in each one. Because you don't naively know at the beginning of a year what company, what sector is going to be the leader. You really want to explore the potential across the entirety of the U.S. small and mid-cap equity market and the U.S. economy and look for opportunities wherever they present themselves.
And why do you take the Russell and not the S&P small cap as a benchmark, since they have already a quality screening?
Yes, and that's a legitimate question. But the reality is the Russell indices are broader. They're more all-inclusive. Mm-hmm. And the S&P 600 doesn't include certain areas that have a lot of potential, such as biotechnology stocks. So because the S&P 600 indices or their small and mid-cap counterpart, they limit companies to ones that already have earnings. They miss a lot of the early stage biotech companies, for example. And we find a lot of alpha there. Now, we have a team of analysts that have PhDs and medical degrees, and they're able to identify these companies from a scientific perspective as well as a stock perspective. Mm-hmm. And so that creates a lot of alpha potential.
Mm-hmm. So you have the know-how to find out the good quality out of the Russell, but if somebody is passive investing, he's better off with the S&P 600 because there's at least a little bit of screening of the quality here.
That's probably true. And if you're going to be in this market for a short period of time, a passive vehicle is a reasonable alternative.
Okay.
If you're only looking for a 3 or 6 month trade, that's probably just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of time, though, I think active investing really creates a lot of opportunities in small cap.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, the small cap is a long-term investment, should be, or even more than the big, the Magnificent Seven or something like this.
I think that history has shown that this is an asset class where the old adage, time in the market is more important than timing the market, really comes into play. Ironically, most of the best days in the small cap market have come during recessions and during bear markets.
Mm-hmm.
And if you miss those best days, you miss a lot of the long-term alpha potential. So it's really an asset class where, despite the perceived volatility, it's better to put your money in a safe place for the long term and let it run, because that's where the alpha comes. You don't necessarily know when those best days are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the approach to that, though, is in designing the strategy that we offer, is to create a strategy that is a little more defensive, a little more stable, less volatile than the market as a whole, that preserves capital in down markets, because they will happen during that long-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
We participate a lot of the upside, but less of the downside, and that means that recognizing we can see more volatility in small cap, we create that smoother ride along the
mm-hmm.
way.
And now the time is good for small caps, you said once, because the Magnificent Seven and all the big ones are quite high in the price right now. And the other thing was really interesting because you said the small caps are more in the domicile than the business is more at home. And do you think of the geographical tensions right now so that you are more safe if you take a company which has a big home market?
Yes. So the U.S. equity market is very focused, when you're talking about the small and mid-cap part of it, on earnings, revenues inside the United States, more so than the world of the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the S&P 500 on a market cap basis is very much a global tech index,
mm-hmm.
whereas the small and mid-cap indices focus on what's going on in the U.S. economy.
So, and to summarize again, what are the advantages and disadvantages of small caps in general?
So the big advantage is the long-term upside potential. They are the source of a lot of innovation. They're source of a lot of alpha creation. And history would show, if you look back for the last 100 years, that there's not as much more downside than large cap than you think, and there's a lot more upside potential. The downside, the disadvantages of investing in small cap is it's hard to find the right partner, the right investor that you can invest with for the long term. Because, as I said, it's getting less and less efficient over time. You really want someone who can find the great opportunities. Some of them are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. Others are going to continue to be small cap for a long time. And there's alpha potential in both.
And what are the criteria that the small cap gets the leader of tomorrow?
Sometimes it's a little luck. Sometimes it's a little skill. I know back earlier in my career when NVIDIA was first a public company, I invested in it. I had no idea that it could be what it is today. But it's sometimes a matter of getting the right management team with the right product at the right time. And others, it's just due diligence and successfully and consistently executing a strategy, continuing to look opportunistically at what the market provides.
Mm-hmm. And at the end, could you mention some huge or bigger holdings in your small cap fund?
So some of our top holdings are names that perhaps an investor outside the United States has never heard of. Frankly, some of them are names that a U.S. investor has never heard of. Our largest holding today is a company called Teledyne Technologies. We put it in the portfolio over a decade ago when it was primarily focused on the defense industry. And over the course of time, it has expanded its array. It still serves defense industries, but it has also applied more technology and expanded into digital imaging. And so it has more of industrial opportunities as well today. Other names in our top 10 list would include a company called Arthur J. Gallagher. It's an insurance brokerage company, very high quality, very successful company. It's one of those large holdings that we're gradually having to say goodbye to. But the company is very successful and continues to outpace some of our efforts to even trim the position. Molina Healthcare, which I mentioned earlier, is a company that started out as a small cap value idea. Now it's a mid cap growth company because of a successful turnaround that the new management team has executed. Waste Connection. Garbage doesn't sound like a really sexy business,
but it's
a very steady business, and the company is a really high quality provider, and they have continued to execute extremely well. And Avery Dennison. Now, again, label making doesn't sound all that exciting, but they have expanded into smart labels, ones that embed things like the provenance, where a product was made, or if it's a food product, when it becomes no longer eligible for sale. By creating that information and putting it in labels, it creates a productivity tool for people all along the supply chain. And productivity enhancements are one of the ways that the United States is going to be able to reshore and bring manufacturing and other products back to the United States.
So you're looking for companies who profit from the reindustrialization in the United States right now?
That is one of the big broad issues or sets of opportunities. It creates opportunities for some of our industrial companies that supply the machinery that goes into those factories. It works for Vulcan Materials, which is an aggregates company, because every time you build a factory, you need to put their aggregates on the under the foundation or under the road surfaces that go to and from that new factory. It helps the distributors. There's their trucking companies that provide services, moving goods around as we bring manufacturing back. And then for every one of the jobs that's created there, there are services, healthcare services, financial services, consumer services that go along with that. So bringing industrial manufacturing back to the shores of the United States has ripple effect throughout the totality of the United States economy.
Yesterday, I heard a lot from fund managers that the service area has higher growth. Do you notice this also, that, for example, software companies or security companies or something like this have more growth than industrials, or won't you say this?
In our part of the market,
I think there's growth opportunities in both the services, the software companies, et cetera, as well as the manufacturing. A lot of the companies in the manufacturing space that we invest in provide tools. Mm-hmm. So it might be a company that provides, say, the brains inside the industrial robots, mm-hmm. Or the tools that allow an automated assembly line to function properly. Mm-hmm. So we can find opportunities there. Software is equally compelling, though. So there's, as I said earlier, opportunities across the entirety of the spectrum, and that's why we have analysts looking at every area of the market. Mm-hmm. Some opportunities are better priced today, or others will be more attractively priced tomorrow. So we have to always be present in every part of the market to make sure we capture them.
Mm-hmm. And for the private investor, would you say it's more important to be diversified in the small cap area?
Absolutely. The opportunities are wide, but the opportunities to stub your toe are also wide. And so having smaller positions in a lot of stocks allows you to avoid the big downdrafts that you might find in one stock or another. And when you do that, then the good names start to shine through more easily.
Mm-hmm. And normally you say if everybody talks about small caps, you do it for a long time, but many do it right now. Isn't it already too late to get into this area segment?
The experience in the past that when small cap stocks start to work, they typically do so for an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. In the wake of the sort of 1973 bottoming of valuations in small cap, small caps went on to outperform large caps for as much as 10 years after that. Happened again after the turn of the century. From 2000, it was not until 2014 until small cap stocks looked truly expensive relative to their large cap counterparts. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely not too late.
And now they are looking truly cheap.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Ward. It was really a pleasure for me, and I got really insights from the small cap area, which I don't cover so much. And I say very much thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alles Gesagte ist nur die persönliche Meinung von Julia Kistner und daher keine Anlageempfehlung und keine Rechts- und Steuerberatung. Für Verluste, die aufgrund von getroffenen Aussagen entstehen, übernimmt die Autorin Julia Kistner keine Haftung.